I've come across a phenomenon that's very common, and that is that people belong to churches, but they don't value them. And I've never actually found that easy to understand, but I suppose that's because I didn't grow up in church. I didn't discover Christ. Christ discovered me when I was 21. God laid hold of me. And very quickly I discovered this wonderful thing, and I still think it's wonderful. It's church. It's the ability to meet with other believers, to share in Jesus Christ, and to share in his Spirit. And yet I find so often that people might say they believe in Jesus, and I've got no reason to doubt them, but somehow they don't value the church. I wonder if they've really thought about what church is. Do they see church as God's household? Do they see it as the assembly of the living God? Do they see it as the pillar and foundation of truth? Have they really got a clear glimpse of what church is? Perhaps it's the fault of the pastors. Perhaps we give the impression that, you know, church is a hobby, or it's just a kind of volunteer organisation or something like that. Perhaps we don't give the right impression. Let's go through this little verse then. Let's ask how it is that this thing is so valuable, this thing that we call church. And the first thing is that it's God's household. God's household. Literally God's house, that's what it says. God's house. And I wonder if we have that vision. Now, when I was a young man, I remember hearing people talking about going to God's house. And I think what they meant was the building. I think they meant something like this. But of course, back in those days, there weren't church buildings, were there? There was no such thing as a church building when this letter was written. So what does he mean when he says it is God's house or household? What he means is that it is a kind of extended family. God's house is the people, not a building. In fact, it's a huge mistake. It's a huge mistake to do that. It's a real sadness that in English we call these buildings churches, because it's so confusing. George Fox, the radical Quaker man, the man who really kicked off the Quaker movement, used to call church buildings steeplehouses. And he and his people used to go out, they'd be real nuisances. On a Sunday, when everyone was going to church, they would shout outside, "This is not a church, this is a steeplehouse. The church is the people of God." And they got arrested for causing a disturbance. But maybe we should do that. Sometimes they'd take all their clothes off, which was a bit radical. But I think their idea was that this is religion without its clothes on. This isn't the real thing. So they take their clothes off, almost as a way of, if you like, insulting the whole idea that this building could be a church. I'm not suggesting anything to anyone here, but it just, you know, that passion to say, look, this is not the church. I think they're right. Unfortunately, every way of trying to solve the problem doesn't really solve it. Many nonconformists called their buildings chapels. And the reason they called them chapels was to say, this is not a church. Up the road, they built something they called a tabernacle, East London Tabernacle. And there was a fashion in Victorian times for calling Baptist buildings tabernacles. You'll know what a tabernacle is, do you? It's an old-fashioned word for a tent. That's what the word tabernacle means. And the reason they did choose such an awkward old word was just to say, look, the church is the people. The church is the community. That's the house of God. And, you know, I sympathise with that. For years, this place was called the Lighthouse Mission, although it never was a mission. But people called it the Lighthouse Mission just to differentiate it from being a church. But there you are. Perhaps words in themselves are just words, but the meaning is important. When you gather, you've come to God's house. You've come to God's house not because you're sat in one of those blue chairs, but because you've come to meet the people who gather around Jesus Christ. That's what it means to be in God's house. Look, if this burnt down, we would still be God's house. And that's very important. It's a wonderful idea. In the ancient world, a wealthy man's house would be quite big. It would contain his wife, or sometimes his wives. It would contain his natural children. Some Romans even had live-in mistresses. I don't know how the women of the house thought about that. And the sort of illegitimate children as well. But on top of that, you would have others. Every person who was a servant was a member of that household. They had slaves in those days. Everyone who was a slave was a member of that household. But also, quite often, they would take on other people as well. If they saw a likely lad who seemed to be good at sums or bright, they would take them into their household and make them work for them. No problem with child labour in those days. And they would adopt them. As soon as they came into the house, they'd be part of the household. And so it would go on. You know, we pray regularly for the Canary Project, and one of the things I learnt about Canary households is that a lot of the people under those roofs are not actually blood relatives. It would be quite normal for a teenage boy or a young man to seek the patronage of an older Canary man and join his household. And he would be one of his boys and he would work for him. He'd be an unpaid security guard. He'd get food and shelter and that would be it. And that's quite common. I'm sure in other cultures it's common. So the idea of a household is not that rather tiny thing that we tend to get in this country. Husband and wife, if they still manage to put up with one another, and two or three kids. But a much bigger affair. A household of 30, 40, 50, 100 people. So the idea is that the household is defined by the man who is the head of the household. People, great men like Julius Caesar, would have had hundreds of people in his household. And here, the idea is that the great man is not a man. The great man is God himself. This is God's household. So these are the people who in some sense belong to God. These are the people who in some sense are his wider family. Now that seems to dignify you, doesn't it? Doesn't it dignify you to say that you are part of God's household? I feel very good about that idea. I'm glad that I can say I'm part of God's household. It puts a status and a standing on me, a value. No one can be valueless who is part of God's household. And it's a privilege. You know, it was a privilege if a very senior Greek or Roman man noticed you enough to invite you to become part of his household. And it's a privilege for us to be invited to be part of this great household of God. So this is one of the things that helps me, at least, to value the church. It is God's extended family. It is God's adopted family. It is God's chosen family, because each one has been invited and each one has freely joined. The idea of Israel was that Israel was meant to be a huge family. Every Israelite was meant to see every other Israelite as a brother. And this is meant to be fulfilled in the household of God. We are meant to see one another as holy brothers and sisters, belonging to each other, most of all, belonging to God. But it's also a dwelling place, isn't it? A dwelling, a household, is where the man lives. It's defined by having the head of the household there. This is where God is, among his people. God living among his people. Okay, let's move on. Church. The church of the living God. The word for church, ecclesia, actually just means an assembly or a gathering. And it comes from the Old Testament. The first gathering of God's people was on a mountain. Do you remember that? Where did God's people first gather on a mountain? There's a look of horror here. People are looking at me as if I'm expecting them to answer my question. Mount Sinai, yeah? You remember? That was what God did. He tore his people out of the grip of Pharaoh. He dragged them out into the desert and he assembled them at Mount Sinai. And that was called the Assembly of Israel. That was the first church. After that, the word assembly was used in the Old Testament to describe the three great festivals when every male in Israel who was grown up three times a year was meant to go to Jerusalem. Imagine how disruptive that was. There you are, working on the farm, busy doing your whatever it is, your carpentry or your weaving. Three times a year, down tools, walk to Jerusalem. And there were these three great assemblies, these great gatherings. And the idea was that the Jews would never forget that God had first of all gathered them out of Egypt, assembled them on Mount Sinai, and given them the law. And three times a year they'd go back and they'd make sacrifices, they'd hear the law read by the priests. And it would be an assembly that belonged to God. The idea was that God said three times a year, you shall assemble or gather unto me. Three times a year, every man in Israel was to gather and stand before God in the holy place. And the purpose of the assembly was to honour and praise, worship God, also to pray for God's grace upon the people, and to receive the grace, to share in eating the sacrifices, the meat, and hear the law of the Lord. Wonderful, wonderful celebrations, at least in theory. Not always valued in practice. But that's the idea of an assembly. When in the New Testament, the churches began gathering on the Lord's Day, early in the morning, they could have called them synagogues. Synagogue is just another word for an assembly. But instead they chose this word ecclesia, because it had this Old Testament background. This idea that just as the Jews had gathered round God on Sinai, so every Lord's Day, the people who had been saved by Jesus would gather round him every Sunday. The gathering of God's people, the assembly of us all. And so as we come together, we do what the Jews did when they had their great assemblies. We pray. We receive God's gifts, the benefit of the sacrifices. Here, of course, the sacrifice being Jesus, and the meal being the bread and wine. As we gather together, we remember what God has done for us. Every time they gathered, it was a memorial of the first great assembly when God gathered his people on Sinai. Every time they gathered, they would repeat the law and remind themselves that they were the only nation that God had ever spoken to. And so that's what church is today. Church today is the assembly, the ecclesia, the gathering, to pray, to receive grace, to share the word of God, and simply to rejoice in the fellowship that we have in Jesus. This is the church of the living God. The church of the God who acts and speaks. So that's the second reason to value church. It is because it is the assembly of God's people around God himself. But the third thing is the one that I think is kind of interesting. And it says the church is the pillar and the ground of truth. The pillar and the ground of truth. And first of all, we want to ask ourselves, what do pillars do in the Bible? This is a hard question, but I know we've got some wise Bible scholars here. What do pillars do in the Bible? Sorry? That's the wrong answer, but it's the one that everyone thinks to say. Because that's what we think of, isn't it? Pillars support things like these. Ah, the pillar of fire, yes, good. Yeah, the pillar of fire did lead in the pillar of smoke, yeah. Generally, in the Old Testament, people erect pillars as memorials. They erect pillars to remind themselves. When they entered the Promised Land, they built a monument, a pillar. Generally speaking, in the Old Testament, they don't build pillars. Pillars are not there to support things. Pillars are monuments. So they erect a pillar. Now, as I was preparing today's talk, I suddenly realised, of course, this is what we do in London, isn't it? If you think about London, we have pillars, don't we, that are memorials. There's a pillar near London Bridge, for instance. Anyone seen that one? Oh, there's a new one, yeah. Okay, I'm talking about the old one. I'm talking about the one that's been there for a couple of hundred years. There's a pillar. Yes. Massive. Stone pillar with a golden fiery ball on top. Okay, anyone know what that's there for? Not a war memorial, good guess. It's a memorial to the Great Fire of London. It used to be free, I don't know if it is. You've got to pay now. Oh, that's so horrible. Everything used to be free. You used to be able, mind you, it was hard work, I think it's a few hundred steps. But you can go up the inside of the monument and look out over London. And that pillar is a monument to the Great Fire. I'm told that the fire started the same distance away from the pillar as the height. So that the height is 100 and something feet. And if the pillar was to fall down the right way, the top of it would land just where the fire started in the baker's shop. Okay, good. Okay, great pillars of London. There's a pillar on the Victoria Embankment on the north side. Anyone seen that one? You could be a guide. Yeah, Cleopatra's Needle. It's an obelisk. Of course it is. Of course it's an obelisk. We all knew that, didn't we? Anyone know what that's a monument to? Because I don't. Tell us what you like, Julie, because we'll believe you. But anyway, it was an Egyptian monument. I think it was more like something we stole, wasn't it?
No, it was a gift.
Was it a gift? Oh, that's a relief. From the Egyptians?
Yes.
Yeah, so obviously it originally commemorated something Egyptian, but I don't know what it was. Okay, pillar number three, Trafalgar Square, Nelson's Column, everyone knows that one, yeah. What year was the Battle of Trafalgar? 1805. What I'm trying to get at is that all of those pillars are monuments to something. It occurred to me afterwards, of course, there's also the cenotaph, isn't there, in Whitehall. That's a big, bulky, white pillar. Do you remember that? And, of course, that's a monument to the millions who died fighting in the First World War. I think it's only a monument to our side, but it's a monument to the millions who died in the First World War. So that's what people do. When something really wonderful or terrible or important happens, people build pillars. Now, let's go back to the church. In what sense are you a pillar? The church is a monument. But the church is a monument to God's grace. What the church is a memorial in the world which shows and reminds people what God has done. And that's what the church is meant to be. It's meant to be the pillar of the truth. Like the pillar by the River Jordan that commemorates the crossing of Jordan when the Israelites entered the Promised Land. Like the pillars that were erected by Jacob and by Abraham to remember God's great works or moments when God spoke to them. So the church is the pillar of the truth of God. It is meant to be a memorial. That means that when people come to church, they should quickly and easily realize that the truth of God has had an effect in the world. It's part of our witness to belong to churches. And no Christian is a very useful witness if they don't belong to a church. All they're a witness to is their own opinion. But if we belong to a church, that is the pillar, the memorial to the gospel. Okay, well, that's enough pillar spotting. What about moving on to the other thing it says there? The pillar is also the foundation of the truth. And the idea here is basically of support. It's the base level, the ground. The foundation of a building is that solid, unmovable base upon which you can lay your bricks, or the mason can lay his stones. The foundation is the fundamental support. To put it another way, it's a launch pad. You know, when they shoot these massive rockets into space, they first of all have to use thousands of tons of concrete to build a solid pad for it to shoot off from. It's a foundation. And it's our business to be a foundation for the truth. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we invent our own gospel. The gospel is given us. In that sense, the foundation is Jesus himself, or Jesus and his apostles. But we are, in another sense, the launch pad, the base ground level upon which God can build, if we stay true to God's truth. If we don't, if we abandon the truth of the Bible, then we just become another human organization. But we are meant to be the foundation of the truth, so the truth can work among us, so the truth can build among us, so that the truth, which is ultimately Jesus, can be revealed by the church. I don't know why it is, but so many mission organizations seem not to value churches, when actually without churches the mission of the church is impossible. It's very interesting to me that when the Apostle Paul decided to go to a new place, he took his own little church with him. He'd always go with a group of 8 or 10 people. Because, in a sense, if I talk to you about God on my own, I am just giving you my opinion. But if I'm speaking from a foundation, from a base, and instead of saying, I believe, I say, we believe, if there is a genuine unity of faith, then people have something they can lay hold of. They have something they can build their lives on. So the church is not just the monument of the truth, commemorating or displaying what God has done. The church is also the foundation upon which the church builds. I have never met a vibrant, healthy Christian person who did not value the church of Jesus Christ. It is God's household. It is the church of the living God. It is the pillar, and it is the foundation of the truth. It's a glorious vision, really, isn't it? It's a glorious vision of people like you and me. Not super Christians, not anything highly terrific and brilliant and wise. This is how God sees us. Sometimes we don't even see ourselves in the way God sees us. But that is how the Apostle Paul saw the church. This is why he wrote the letter. He says, I'm writing to you so that people know how to conduct themselves in the church. And in a sense, I think what he's trying to do there is to communicate the value. So when, for instance, he tells Timothy, tell these heretics to shut up, which he does, it's not because he just takes pleasure in being right. It's because they're not conducting themselves properly in the household of God. When he tells people to stop arguing and live at peace with one another, it's not just because he's a man who likes a quiet life. It's because this is how people should conduct themselves. When he says, stop competing, stop looking down on each other, it's because that's not appropriate behavior. That's not the way to conduct yourself in the household of God. And many other things as well. If people are hungry in the church, let's feed them. Because this is the household of God. These are your family. He talks about providing for widows. Because these widows are part of the household of God, and therefore we should act with regards to them as we would with our own granny. And so it goes on. Throughout 1 Timothy, lots of instructions on how to live, how to respect, how to love one another. Why? Because this is the church of the living God. This is his household. These are his people. This is the pillar and the foundation of the truth. And the more we catch that vision of the value of church, not just this church, but every church that worships Jesus, then the wiser and the healthier I think we will be too. Are there any questions or thoughts?